Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about how a mother's stress while she's pregnant affects the baby through the amniotic fluid, new research from the University of Zurich, and then how fear can develop out of others' trauma. This is from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. I'll explain why that's so important, how many people today are walking around a bundle of nerves. They're stressed out. Well, they may not be aware of it, but if there's someone in their family or immediate relationship who has undergone any kind of trauma, emotional or physical, that's being transmitted and it manifests as fear in them. I'll talk about that. I've had a lot of people ask me about mosquitoes. Well, I just came where there were a lot of mosquitoes. I've been filming. I'm back in New York City now. It's nice to be back. Just walking down the street my first day, I must have ran into 30 people who said hello, and everybody is asking different questions. And so I'm going to give an answer for mosquito protection. Also, a lot of people have been calling, talking about ticks and Lyme's disease. So I'm going to give you one of the best things you can do for Lyme's disease. Also, how from Georgetown University, research on resveratrol can regulate the neuroinflammatory and inducing conditions of the brain if you have Alzheimer's. In other words, how to improve the immune system if you have Alzheimer's, and a lot more on health and healing. Then today, from our public health segment, I'm going to talk about finally studies are in, and now there's absolute irrefutable proof that unvaccinated children are far healthier than those who've been vaccinated. In fact, the latest research I'll be quoting from GreenMed Info that collected all the actual studies shows that there can be upwards of a 2,000% increase in different conditions if you're vaccinated. I'm sure many of you who are into rock heard that Chris Connell of the Soundgarden had committed suicide, and his family is angry about it and is speaking up. Why? They believe it's the anti-anxiety prescription that altered his state of consciousness. So we'll talk about that, and I'll read you something from Dr. Kelly Brogan, MD, on this topic, and I'll add in material from a brand new documentary that won't be released just yet, but is finished, called Manufacturing Madness, and a series of nearly 30 articles that I'm developing from the information that is the most comprehensive look at the neurological industry. And I call it an industry because it's not a science, and how much damage they've done to millions of Americans and people throughout the world. So we're going to deal with that. Also today, my guest in the second part of our program will be a continuation of our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. He is Professor Alan Lichtman. Now, he's the distinguished professor of history. He's a political historian and at American University in Washington. He also successfully predicted every single presidential winner since 1984, including that Donald Trump would win. So we're going to talk about rules of impeachment and the case against Donald Trump. Is there one? If not, why not? If there is, what is it? This will be an extremely important discussion. And I've got an audio clip that I think you will appreciate. In fact, I've got several audio clips, and we're getting all ready for next. A week from today, we'll be premiering our new online Facebook and YouTube streaming live of the radio program, where you'll be able to watch not just the program, but you'll be able to watch me interview the guests on Skype as well as live in the studio, but you'll also be able to see the different documentaries we have selected to play clips from that are relevant to social issues. We have over 100 already selected, ready to go, and you'll see our new state-of-the-art studios. But we're going to play today The Government Investigates. You've all heard how either side, well, the Republicans say we should have investigated Hillary Clinton better and they should have investigated Comey for not indicting her because the rules of the actual law said you don't have to prove intent. If you break the law, it doesn't matter what your intent is, but that also wasn't the wasn't within the domain of the FBI director. You see, the FBI and the FBI director have no rights to bring a case. In fact, they can't bring a case. They can research, they can do their homework, they can investigate, then they turn that over to the Justice Department. Remember, the FBI works for the Justice Department. And the FBI director has his own supervisor. The Deputy Attorney General is the boss of the FBI director. It is the FBI director saying, okay, we researched Hillary Clinton, here are all the facts, and then that person takes that back into the different lawyers inside the Justice Department who decides to convene a grand jury, and then if information is there to do the indictment. That is not, on any level, the right of the attorney or the FBI director to do that. So needless to say, and rightly so, many people were concerned, why did he step over all these boundaries? On the other side, you have all the Democrats saying, why aren't we seeing more transparency and openness? We haven't seen all of Trump's tax records. So everybody wants to investigate everybody. So we're going to play you a clip about that. Also, time permitting, Children's Medical Safety Research Institute, the first of its kind study of vaccinated versus unvaccinated American homeschooled children shows who's really ailing, and parents should be concerned. And also partnering with parents, and this was through the Autism Intensive, an expert interview series for providing additional input to parents who want to know what to do if you have autism. So as you see, we cover a lot of bases today. Let's begin. I believe that grapes are one of nature's most perfect foods. In fact, I would put it in the top 10. The apple's also in there. Now I'm talking about organic grapes. Why? Three things. The grape seed, the grape skin, and the flesh. And in all that, you get a particular nutrient called resveratrol. Res, R-E-S, vera, V-E-R-A, trol, T-R-O-L. There are over 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature about how important it is and what it does for your heart, for your brain, for your circulatory system, for your anti-aging, for lengthening the telomeres, which are the end cap proteins on chromosomes. The quicker they turn over, the quicker you die. The longer they last, the longer you live at the cellular level. This is the latest from Georgetown University, and it's about looking at the neurodegenerative diseases and conditions. Alzheimer's have been at the top of that list. Dementia's right behind it. And according to new information, they found that being given resveratrol regulates in a good way the neuroinflammation and induces adaptive immunity in Alzheimer's disease, which means that if you have Alzheimer's at any level, according to this placebo-controlled study, you should be taking resveratrol. It can help your brain, helps your immune system. That's good. I'm sure you've seen those ads on television for the gummy vitamins for kids. According to The Conversation, they're not healthy. Now, there are many brands of these kids' gummies on the market. Now, some of them may be all right, some of them not. And it's understandable how some parents would want their kids to get the best possible vitamin, but a lot of kids are finicky, and the parents are not willing to go through the process using some common sense. Take the best vitamins you can for your child, including the omega-3 fatty acids and vitamin D, vitamin C, quercetin, calcium, magnesium, and zinc, and you just put them into a blender. And that way, whatever their favorite flavor, strawberry, throw some strawberries in. Chocolate, throw some chocolate in. But then they're getting their nutrients. That's the ideal way of doing it, especially for finicky. But did you ever look at the active ingredients on the label. They're usually listed as vitamins, minerals, and sometimes omega-3 fatty acids, and sometimes vegetable powders. They may say they contain sugars, but it doesn't mean they're going to tell you how much sugar and what the sugars are. And that's not really good. Now, here's what they say. Quote, in our opinion, these products are unhealthy and exploitative. Their high sugar content may appeal to young children, but they're not a good introduction to a healthy diet. Dental caries are a significant public health problem. It goes on to talk about the billions of dollars that it costs public health agencies to help with children's bad oral hygiene. And sugars provide food for the bacteria that dissolve tooth enamel. And as sugar consumption increases, so do cavities. And that this damage is irreversible, and individuals are left with lifelong problems that require fillings and possibly root canal or extractions. In addition, food acid causes dental erosion that can lead to the progressive loss of surface tooth enamel. And this may require complex and lengthy treatments involving fillings, veneers, and crowns. And the sticky consistency of gummies adds to the problem. And the World Health Organization says higher rates of dental caries occur when the intake of free sugars, those are the syrups and the fructose and the other sugars, are more than 10% of total energy requirements. And you're getting a lot of more than that in your average consumption. So that's what we should know. So my suggestion is, if you're going to give a gummy, look carefully at the label. If it does not explain the source of everything, don't buy it. Buy one instead that is high quality and gives you every ingredient, including the additional ingredients. Because it's in those additional ingredients, they frequently put some form of whey or casein, which is dairy. So you may want your child to be dairy-free because of their common allergens to milk products. So look at those other ingredients. Now, mosquito time, what do you do? There's two things you can definitely do. In fact, I did one myself because I'm in a very, for the last 2 weeks, a very mosquito-infested area. And so I wanted to get my workouts in, and I did the following. I suggest you try it as well. I simply sprayed my running outfit up around my neck, my arms and hands and legs, with rubbing alcohol. And I didn't get a single mosquito bite because evidently mosquitoes don't like alcohol. And even when I had to go into the woods to do some filming, where you can't imagine the amount of mosquitoes you find in the morning, no bites, no mosquitoes. So that's something you should consider. You spray yourself, arms, hands, legs, back, and your clothes. The second is catnip, C-A-T-N-I-P, catnip. According to Iowa State University, researchers report that the essential oil in catnip that gives the plant that characteristic odor is about almost 100%, no, excuse me, 1,000% more effective at repelling mosquitoes than DEET. That's the very dangerous chemical that's used in most of the commercial insect repellents. It also is used in all the outfits of all of the soldiers that go overseas. In fact, when I was doing my first articles on Gulf War syndrome, I was asking every single thing they were exposed to, and no one ever thought that their uniforms were a problem, but they are, because when you're in some of these climates, you have a lot of mosquitoes. So they use DEET, and that's not good. So anyhow, the finding was reported at the current issue of the American Chemical Society, the world's largest scientific society, and by the same Iowa State University research group that 2 years ago discovered that catnip also repels cockroaches. So what you do, you can do three things to get rid of cockroaches. You mix equal parts boric acid and borax. And you can also use baking soda. You then spray that with catnip. And you put that around the border of your kitchen and underneath your cabinets where your sinks are, and it'll kill cockroaches. So those are the things that make a difference with mosquitoes and with and also with cockroaches. And it's easy to use. These are not difficult. Now, for those of you who have problems with ticks, and by the way, we've never seen this amount of people suffering from Lyme's disease or tick bites. There are massive infestations of ticks now. And part of it has to do with climate change, because as climates change so rapidly, nature cannot change as quickly. Trees have immune systems. Trees' root systems communicate with one another. If there's a sick tree, that tree gives off certain acids to try to protect itself from beetles that will infest it. And did you ever notice if you have a fresh apple sitting on a table? Nothing happens. Now eat that apple and leave the core, and within about 15 minutes, you see these tiny little flies all over it. Where'd they come from? Why don't they go after fresh fruit? They always go after something that's rotting. And so in nature, beetles know which has a tree is strong and which is diseased, which is dehydrated, which lacks hydration and makes it easier for it to infiltrate and infest. How bad is it? 100 million trees have died in California because of the drought. Now, people in California are saying, yeah, but the drought is over. No, it's not. You had the benefit of El Nino, which gave you about three times the amount of rain you would normally expect. It filled up the reservoirs. But here's what happened in the process. All that rain also created new growths of grass everywhere. And as that grass and greenery starts to grow, the moment it becomes dry again, you've now doubled, tripled, or quadrupled your risk of fires. We have all that new growth that's now dying. So the drought has not gone away. You're still on an earthquake fault that's extremely precarious. You still have a lot of pollution. Excuse me. And you are extremely vulnerable to infestations. Now, what happens is now we're seeing, even in the Alps, in Switzerland and other countries, we're seeing new types of flowers, new types of trees and shrubs growing further and further up into the mountains because it's warmer. But you also see insects that were once not going at certain altitudes. Now you see those insects because they follow the disease pattern in dryness. So what do you do about the tick? Here's what I've done my entire adult life. And mind you, I've always lived on a farm or a ranch. I live on a ranch now. And used to live upstate New York in Stone Ridge on a farm for 14 years, down in Texas, the Healing Springs Ranch, and living on a ranch now. Why no ticks? Why? Why none of the dogs or animals have any ticks? Diatomaceous earth. It's inexpensive. You can go to, generally you purchase it, you want to purchase it in bulk, so purchase it online. You'll save money. It could go about $30 for about 10 pounds. It can be expensive, but you generally get it at a swimming pool because it's used in purification of water. What is it? Well, it's a very fine powder. It's made up of phosphorylized materials. And what happens is that you take a normal seed spreader, you put it in, and you go up and down the area that you want to cover, the grass. And you should go about 100 yards beyond your normal area. And then you need at least 2 days of dry. Now, this powder is very fine, and it settles down into the grass, the weeds, the leaves, and it goes down to the ground. As spiders, ticks, fleas walk across it, it cuts their body, and they die of dehydration. So that's why it's so important. So that's first in preventing. Secondly, make sure if you have a dog or cat that every week, every day you should be brushing their teeth, by the way. Most people, what? You got to brush your teeth? Yeah, every day. If not, they're going to end up with losing their teeth. It's very expensive to get them extracted. Then they're going to get infections up in their gums. Those local infections are going to drain their immune system. Next thing you know, you got a dead dog, dead cat. So brush their teeth, but once a week, take some hydrogen peroxide and on a ear cleaner, and generally use cotton, soak it, take it in the air gently, and wipe it around. And you take the out, and you think, wow, what's all that brown, gooey, smelly stuff? That's what the animal collects in there. It's also where a lot of ticks collect. So you can get fleas, ticks, and also a lot of the bad dog smell comes from dirty ears. Clean the ears. You help with ticks. You help with fleas. Then take a flea comb, and you just sit there, and it's great because it's creating the love hormone between you and your animal. Because as you're stroking with the comb, that's petting him. That's stimulating the central nervous system. No different than if you had a loved one who was just sitting behind you and massaging your head. Well, you know how that feels. That feels great. And that's what you're doing with your animal. But you're also, as you stroke with a flea comb, you look at the comb, and if you see any little black dot, that's a flea. You just push it between your thumb and forefinger, kills it, and just wipe it off. And then you can see how many fleas the dog is or cat's getting. That makes a big difference, and also ticks as well. But let's say you went to the beach. You went to Jones Beach, if you live in New York, a community beach. And you're out there for an hour, and you go home. And the next morning you wake up, and you got a pain in your leg, and you look back on your calf, and you got this little circle, and it's all red. Looks like a bullseye, and you think, wow, what's that about? I wasn't in the woods. I took a white sheet with me when I went out to Jones Beach to sit on the beach and just enjoy the water, the people. Within 1 hour, I counted 3 ticks on my sheet. Had I not had the white sheet, I couldn't have seen the ticks. But I saw the ticks, killed the ticks, enjoyed the beach, and went home. Something simple, a white sheet. And you see what's on there. We all love bucolic, being close to nature. But in all those bucolic scenes today, what you're going to see more often than not is you're going to end up seeing someone who can't spend more than a minute in any given location because they're going to be covered with ticks. And once you get that tick bite, you may not even know that you have Lyme's disease. So, what to do? The moment you have a tick on you, and you don't know whether or not that's an actual Lyme tick, take 2 drops of wild oregano oil and put it right on the tick. Now, a lot of people make the mistake of trying to break the tick off, you know, pull it off, burn it off. No, wild oregano oil on a tick, and boy, it lets go, and it gets out of there quickly, then you can kill the tick. Then colloidal silver, where the tick was starting to bite, and that can help to kill much of the spirochete activity in the bacteria that's in the immediate area. Just a suggestion to help you. Now on to something else. How fear can develop outside of others' traumas. This is from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. So what happens in the brain when you see other people experiencing a trauma or being subjected to pain? The same regions that are involved when we feel pain ourselves are also activated when we observe other people who appear to be going through some painful experience. Now, this is shown in this study from the Karolinska Institute, published in Nature Communications, a highly respected publication. But we are sensitive to different degrees to learning fear from other people, and one explanation would appear to be found in the endogenous opiate system. Now, seeing others express pain or anxiety can give us important information about things around us that are dangerous and should be avoided. Now, sometimes, however, we can develop fear of situations that, rationally speaking, are not dangerous. The opiate system is supposed to alleviate pain and fear, but it does not work as effectively in all of us, which might be one of the reasons why some people develop anxiety syndrome merely by seeing others experience a trauma. Here's what the study says, quote, some people are overly sensitive to this form of social learning. Our study shows that the endogenous opiate system affects how sensitive we are and may explain why some people develop post-traumatic stress disorder merely by observing others who are experiencing traumatic events. After terror attacks, sensitive people might be afraid even if they themselves were not present, end quote. And they actually proved this in a double-blind study. So what does this mean? Let me explain this in lay language. Not long ago, I interviewed over 1,200 veterans, and I was producing a documentary at the time called Gulf War Syndrome, Killing Our Own. And then after that, I produced American Veterans Forgotten and Betrayed. This was a real eye-opener for me. First, I didn't know that there were 16,000 homeless vets living in the woods with no water, no food, no electricity. In fact, one guy, I'm guessing he's in early 30s, when I came up to him, it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. It was a cold morning for North Florida, and it was about 40 degrees, and all he had on was a T-shirt, and he's huddled under a tree, curled up, trying to keep warm. Now, in the immediate vicinity, there were some pup tents where guys were sleeping, but these are kids' pup tents. So half their body was in the pup tent, the other half their legs were outside. And so I talked with them. I spent the whole day with them, filming, and I learned several things. First, I learned that a lot of their trauma came not from what they did, but what they saw others doing. One guy had been so traumatized by what he saw night after night, they would go in Iraq, into Baghdad, they would break down people's doors, people would be screaming, they would take them out, they would put them on their knees, put their hands behind their bed, ahead, and then anyone over the age of 12, they would arrest as a suspected terrorist. But these weren't terrorists, they were just normal citizens. And the prisons were so full, they keep building more prisons just to house these thousands upon thousands of people who had not been convicted of any crime. But then you find out there's a bounty system. How's that work? Well, someone says, I believe that guy is a bomb maker. I believe that guy is a, you know, Al-Qaeda. And you go and arrest him. That guy who dropped the dime on him, he gets a reward. Might be 1,500, 2,000. But 99% of those are just false. What happens when you're seeing people look up and this guy said, I'm looking at a boy, scared to death, a little skinny kid, his family's on the ground, and the sergeant comes over and says, arrest the kid. And the guy looks at the sergeant and says, he's a kid. We found no weapons. We found nothing in the house. And he says, I don't care. Arrest him. Now, when you get arrested, you get tied up with those tight plastic ties. You get sent to prison. You're deprived of food and water. You're beaten. We saw Abu Ghraib. We saw what they did. It was degrading. And only a few people were held accountable to that. And really no one higher up. But they didn't focus upon how many people died from torture, how many people died from being beaten, how many people died because a group of dogs were with a guy who was had his hands tied behind his back. Well, what kind of coward does that? So every time one of these jerks over at Fox says, oh, these are our heroes, well, prove you're a hero by sacrificing something in the right cause and show that you were right in what you did. That's a hero. The mere fact you're in the armed forces doesn't qualify for you being a hero. So these guys came back, and now they can't sleep at night. Now they're all wound up. Now they're feeling terrible because of what they experienced or the trauma they saw others put through. And so that's what it means. You may see someone else being put through a bad situation, and you take on that person's energy, and now you live in fear. Not that you've done anything, but you live in fear. So this is called part of the conditional epigenetics. Let's say you grew up in a house and you got four kids, and one of the kids seems to always be the target of one of the parents' anger. You can end up traumatized and living with fear, not because you had anything said or done to you, but by one of your siblings. So that's what we're seeing. So it's a whole new way of understanding people's dysfunctional behavior. They're responding personally to other things they've witnessed in this world. And this also is from the University of Zurich and is similar. It says, a mother's stress affects the baby through amniotic fluid. Quote, if the mother is stressed over a longer period of time during pregnancy, the concentration of stress hormones in amniotic fluid rises, as proven by an interdisciplinary team of researchers from the University of Zurich. Short-term stress situations, however, do not seem to have an unfavorable outcome on the developing fetus, however, when it's chronic. So let's just say that you have someone who has chronic stress, for whatever reason, legitimate or not, who's pregnant. Here's the bad news. Your child is more likely to develop ADHD and end up with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or cardiovascular disease is going to increase. The precise mechanisms of how stress affects the baby in the womb is not yet completely clarified, but that it does, yes. So stress hormones affect the fetus. Stress hormones affect the heart. So whatever that mother's going through, it can end up having profound negative effect upon the child. Now to finish this up with our public health segment. This is from Christina England of GreenMed Info. And I'm only going to give you, I haven't posted on our website, but I'm only going to give you just a short piece of it. Quote, four different studies spanning 25 years prove vaccinated children are at a greater risk of serious illness and neurological disorders than their non-vaccinated peers. For many years, parents and professionals have been questioning whether or not any studies have been conducted comparing vaccinated children to unvaccinated children. In fact, Congressman Posey put this very question to Ms. Colleen Doyle from the CDC and Prevention, and as expected, Ms. Doyle made several attempts to avoid Mr. Posey's question before finally being forced to admit that, no, the CDC had not carried out such a study. So this left parents feeling let down by the one organization that they had always trusted and feeling frustrated by the lack of such a study. So now they show it, and I got the studies in my hand here, and I'm looking at the results, and they are really staggering. And they measured everything from tonsillitis and hyperactivity and diabetes and epilepsy and ear infections and eczema and ear glue ear and asthma. And if you were vaccinated, you had a really high percentage of having these things happen. Quote, during this study, another interesting fact emerged. Researchers discovered that 92% of the children requiring a tonsillectomy operation had received the measles vaccine, indicating that the vaccination for measles may have made some of the children more susceptible to tonsillitis. The study revealed also that 81 of the families had both vaccinated and unvaccinated children, and the family stated that the unvaccinated children were healthier. So, asthma, all kinds of children. 117,416 children were followed. And again, asthma and hay fever and neurodermatitis were very common in those vaccinated, very uncommon in those who weren't. Plus, they tested them for metals. Of these, the children got the vaccines, had high levels of mercury, aluminum, arsenic. And there you are. They had a greater, if you were vaccinated, you had a greater propensity for dyslexia, speech delay, articulation problems, sensory processing, anxiety, depression, bedwetting, celiac disease, gluten sensitivity, and GERD, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease. So we don't have one, we have four studies now that show this. I'll hold my other study for tomorrow on Dr. Kelly Brogan's violence-inducing effects of psychiatric medication. Also, over the weekend while I was sitting in an airport waiting to fly back home, I started doing some research about how many musicians have died in just the last couple of years. It's over 40. We're talking about some very famous people. Some younger ones, some middle-aged, some older ones, but none of them dying of natural causes, heart attacks, strokes. And it doesn't mean that these people were living unhealthy lives at the time of their death. Over the weekend, Greg Allman. Now, living near the Beacon Theater, I love it every year when the Allman Brothers band comes by so I can go down and pop in and see a concert. And they give one of the best concerts ever, one of the longest concerts, and they really rock. Well, he died of cancer, but he had had hepatitis C, and he wasn't in good health. But you have to go back earlier in their life and see, okay, there was a time when this artist did this drug and this smoking and drinking and sleep deprivation. But that was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Why are they dying of that now? Because here's the idea. The fact that you have made mistakes with your body doesn't mean that the body was able to recover and repair all those mistakes. So come October, when I do my next retreat, I'm going to set aside a week after everyone else has left just to work with musicians who want to go in and repair the damage from a lifetime of abuse to save them. And I'm always saddened after I hear someone dying because I thought, God, I could help that person. No need for that person to have died. That person to have died. I've reversed that. I could do that. So if you know anyone who's a musician, the third week of October is Musician Week. I'm going to help them detox, reverse their aging, repair their liver, their kidney, their heart, their brain, to try to get them back if they want that. And if they do, then you'll reach out and they can call my office and leave their name and number and we'll have someone contact them. Hopefully we'll save some of these wonderfully creative people's lives. And then they, in turn, if they've had their life turned around, wouldn't that be nice if they get up on stage and says, hey, I'm here today in no small measure because I now am on a plant-based diet. And it's taught me things I didn't know. I didn't need to eat all that animal protein this whole life. And there are ways I can deal with my stress without doing something stupid. So it's a way of sharing something where people will pass it on. Now, our guest is on hold, Professor Alan Lichtman. But before we go to, no, you know what? We're going to go to him. I'm going to save the clip for tomorrow. And because tomorrow on this program, we are launching a brand new anti-war campaign. And I'm having people on, some great scholars, some you've never heard of before, others you have, because it's time that the anti-war movement and the anti-regime change movement coalesces so we can say no more wars, no more intervening in other people's affairs, no more undermining democratically elected governments, no more killing union leaders in South America and Honduras, no more of this. And right now, we just don't have what we could call a viable anti-war movement. And there's a reason why. Because some people on the left, some popular people on the left, are actually pro-war and pro-imperialism. They need to be called out. We have to let people know we're not all fitting under this one title. So if you really are a progressive, then you should be against regime change and war and spying. So tomorrow, we start that. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
Girl, try to remember when we didn't have no shoes. We stuck together, just me and you. Give it all up for another guy. Baby, I'm telling you, don't let dream that's fool ya. Don't let it change your mind.
Let's now go down to Maryland. We're standing by as Professor Alan Lichtman. I gave you his bio earlier. He is the Distinguished Professor of History, a political historian at American University in Washington, D.C., and he's become widely known for having successfully predicted every presidential winner since 1984, including the most recent election of Donald Trump. He is the author of some very important works and dozens of articles, including The Case for Impeachment, which reviews both Trump's business and political background and dealings, and Congressional Abuse of Power, and Why His Habitual Misconduct of Violating the Public Trust Bears Forth a Case for His Removal from Office. Also, Alan holds degrees from Brandeis University and a doctorate from Harvard University. Nice to have you with us today.
My great pleasure, Gary.
Before we take a look at the evidence in Trump's business dealings and time so far in the White House, can you please make your case for his impeachment? And I'd like you to begin by having you share what you observed in this last election that indicated to you that Trump would win, even back in September when all the pundits and media heads, with few exceptions, felt certain Hillary would be in the White House now. So what did you observe that the rest of us didn't?
Yes, I was able to correctly predict the outcome because I paid no attention to the polls, didn't follow the pundits, didn't look at the day-to-day events of the campaign, which is like looking at the foam on the waves. Instead, I looked at the deep tides, the big picture that actually turns elections, according to my well-established prediction system, the keys to the White House, which has correctly forecasted presidential election results since 1984, over a 30-year track record. And the basic proposition behind the keys is to forget the polls, forget the pundits, forget the campaign. American presidential elections are primarily judgments up or down on the performance of the party holding the White House. In other words, will the American people give the incumbent party four more years? And using that system, I was able to discern many vulnerabilities of the incumbent Democrats who held the White House. They took a pasting in the 2014 midterm elections. Their sitting president couldn't run again. Open seats are tough. They had an unexpectedly contentious nomination struggle. They had all these difficult third parties running way over their heads. The Obama administration didn't follow up the Affordable Care Act with a comparable domestic policy accomplishment in the second term, understandable given a Republican Congress. And the administration didn't follow up the dispatch of bin Laden in the first term with a comparable foreign policy triumph in the second term. So you can see these things had nothing to do with the conventional wisdom, but had a lot to do with the strength and performance of the party holding the White House. With respect to my second prediction, which I made at the very same time in September of 2016 that I made with respect to the election, and that was that Donald Trump would not last for 4 years, but would be subject to impeachment. Interestingly, Donald Trump himself actually wrote me a note saying, congrats, Professor, good call on my prediction of his win. He apparently didn't read far enough to see my second big prediction, which is now, of course, the title of my book, The Case for Impeachment. Why, as early as September of 2018, was I able to discern that Donald Trump was more vulnerable to impeachment than any other president in the history of the country? Certainly entering the White House is what we're talking about. Well, first of all, Donald Trump would be the only president in the history of the country to be elected without a shred of public service. That is, as an elected official, as an appointed official, or like Dwight Eisenhower or Ulysses Grant, a member of the military. Instead, he spent his whole life enriching himself, often at the expense of others. I think one of the telling reasons he won't release his tax returns, nothing to do with being audited, that doesn't stop it. Rather, he doesn't want the American people to see how stingy he's been with his charitable contributions. Not only has he spent his whole life enriching himself, he has also spent his life enriching himself at the expense of others, without ever being held accountable. And this is critical. He has avoided accountability by declaring bankruptcy and leaving others to take real dollar losses while he takes big phony dollar reductions on his income taxes, which enable him to vastly reduce his payments in later years. He's avoided accountability by protracting litigation, by settling it out for peanuts. He's avoided accountability by walking away from failed projects. I talked in the case for impeachment about Trump Tower Tampa and Trump Tower Fort Lauderdale. And he has a history of flouting the law. He's very early in his career, he was sued in a very credible case by the United States Department of Justice for violating the Fair Housing Act. And even recently, there's very credible evidence that his model agency employed illegal immigrant workers without going through the proper procedures. And he has a history of lying. He got into politics on the back of the biggest, most protracted, most insidious lie in the history of American politics. The lie that America's first African-American president, Barack Obama, was an illegitimate president because he was really born in Africa, not in Hawaii. Of course, he had not a shred of credible evidence to back up that lie, but he kept pushing it for years and years, and it served him extremely well in politics. So these were things that I was able to discern long before he actually became president, which led to my first prediction and ultimately to my current book, The Case for Impeachment.
Okay, even before Trump's inauguration, there was talk and plans underway for impeaching him. Free Speech for People, founded by constitutional attorney John Boniface, is one such group, and articles and calls to concertedly attempt to bring articles of impeachment forward have increased exponentially since then. And recently, the nonpartisan organization, the Economist Intelligence Unit, with countries represented around the world, upgraded Trump's likely impeachment to moderate level. And now Texas Representative Al Green is reported to have started articles for impeachment. My understanding is that what a president does in his private life and business dealings before entering office, unless it is outright and irrefutably criminal, are not grounds for impeachment. Therefore, the strongest case against a president should be what he or she does while in office. And two of the issues that seem to get the most attention are his supposed dealings with foreign powers, yet to be proven, and notably the Russians, and in winning the election, and then second, his conflicts of interest meddling in the business dealings for personal profit while in office, such as the breaching emollient clauses. And then what is your review of these two charges, and are there stronger charges, particularly with respect to the abuse of power that Alexander Hamilton realized as financial corruption, that we should be made aware of?
Great question. In the case for impeachment, I don't make a political case for impeaching Donald Trump. I'm very clear in the book to say you don't impeach a president because you don't like him, you don't like his style, or you don't like his policies. As you correctly point out, following Hamilton, you would impeach a president, and I quote from this in the book, because of the abuse or violation of some public trust that relates to injuries done immediately to the society itself. That suggests several things. First, an impeachable offense need not be an indictable crime. It could be an abuse of power that's not a crime, such as violating the Emoluments Clause, as you point out. In addition, it indicates that the framers put impeachment not in the courts as a strictly legal process, but in the Congress, a political body. So impeachment is a combined moral, legal, and political judgment. And finally, I would take slight issue with what you said about impeachable acts committed before you take the oath of office. There's no prohibition on that in the Constitution. Some judges have been impeached in part for actions before they took the bench, and certainly if there is strong evidence of collusion between the Trump team and the Russians and Trump knew about it, or heaven forbid, Trump himself was involved, even though that occurred before the inauguration, that certainly would be grounds for impeachment. In fact, now Attorney General, then Jeff Sessions, in speaking about prior impeachments, did indeed himself endorse the view that actions prior to inauguration could be impeachable. Now, in addition to the obvious possible impeachment for collusion with the Russians and the obvious possible impeachment for conflicts of interest and violation of the Emoluments Clause, which, by the way, is an absolute prohibition. It says if you're president and you're not explicitly authorized by Congress, you can't take anything of value from a foreign power. There's no monetary amount specified. There's no quid pro quo required. And already we know Trump has accepted some potentially very valuable trademarks from nations such as China and Mexico, arguably directly violating the Emoluments Clause. But beyond that, I think there are some other cases to be made. First is the obstruction of justice. Remember how hot Republicans were to impeach Bill Clinton on obstruction of justice. And he was obstructing, presuming that he was, a private consensual affair that had nothing to do with security of the country or the Constitution. Trump, if he's found guilty of obstruction, is obstructing an investigation into the most serious of matters that deeply affects the future of our democracy and the security of our country. It's orders of magnitude more serious than anything Clinton was involved in. And already, you know, the evidence is pretty overwhelming. There's, of course, the firing of Comey, his admission that he had Russia on his mind when he fired Comey, the lies that the administration issued about the reasons for the firing of Comey. There are allegations that he asked Comey to back off the Russia investigation, that he pressured members of the intelligence community to try to get the FBI and others to back off the investigation. We know for sure that there was collusion between the White House and Representative Nunes to derail the House investigation into the Russia connection. The collusion was so blatant that Representative Nunes had to stand down. We know for sure that even after being warned by Attorney General Sally Yates that the National Security Advisor posed a threat to national security, Trump kept him on for 18 days. That's more than enough for probable cause, at least on obstruction of justice on a very serious matter. Another point I made that a lot of people think is kind of edgy and far out, but I think is really important, is impeachment for a crime against humanity. Now, we typically consider crimes against humanity to be things like genocide, like what happened in Cambodia in the 70s. But the International Criminal Court has very recently prioritized crimes against the environment, which would include, of course, catastrophic climate change. And here's the rub. In 2009, a group of businessmen sent a letter to then-President Obama saying, the scientific evidence is irrefutable that unless we take strong action against climate change, the consequences are going to be catastrophic. And doing so won't hurt the economy. It'll help it by moving us into a new era. Who signed that letter? Donald Trump, Ivanka Trump, Donald Jr., and Eric Trump. What has changed in 7+ years? The science is even stronger. The threat is even more urgent. But only Donald Trump's political calculation that he'd better join the ranks of the deniers or the skeptics if he wants to make it in Republican politics. So he's doing everything in his power to not just to halt, but to throttle back efforts against catastrophic climate change, which he said would be a calamity for the planet 7+ years ago. So I think there is a real case to be made that Donald Trump is committing a crime against humanity by throttling efforts to combat catastrophic climate change. And the Donald Trump of 2009 would be the first one to endorse this.
Okay. I'm sure you're familiar with Dr. John Gardner, a psychiatrist from Johns Hopkins and someone who's spearheading efforts to make the case that Trump has a severe mental disorder and therefore is unfit to lead the nation because he not only endangers the public health, but the planet as well. And as a historian, an expert in our constitutional history, do you believe there is a case at all for this removal based upon psychological grounds? And what is the nation's code that gives legal and constitutional authority for removing a president on psychological or medical grounds?
You got to get the full story of this by reading the case for impeachment. Just you got to get the full story and all the other things I briefly mentioned. I have a whole chapter on this in the case for impeachment. And I point out that my expertise as an historian, which I'll qualify in a moment, that there is an alternative mechanism to impeachment removing a president. It's very difficult. It's never been done. It's in the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, adopted in 1967. And to very, very much simplify it, a president can be removed because he is unfit to carry out the duties of the presidency. And it doesn't say only physical. It could be physical, and it also could be mental. And if you look at the history of the presidency, there has been more serious mental issues than there have been physical issues over time. So look at the presidency of Richard Nixon as a prime example of that. But it's difficult. A majority of the cabinet would have to agree. Of course, Trump appointed his cabinet. So would the vice president. If the president then objects, the case gets punted into Congress, which can remove the president by a two-thirds vote of both houses. This does not require the impeachment procedure. Now, as I said, I'm going to qualify. I'm not a mental health expert. But as you know, maybe three dozen or so mental health experts, some of them quite distinguished, have broken a more than 50-year-old rule called the Goldwater because of the controversy over psychiatrists psychoanalyzing Barry Goldwater in 1964. They've broken this rule, which has stood for over 50 years, to come out publicly and say that they have deep reservations about Donald Trump's temperament and his ability, based on his mental health, to carry out the duties of his office, which could involve the invocation of the 25th Amendment. But then again, got to have the cabinet and you got to have the vice president on board. Very, very difficult to do.
Professor Alan Lichtman, thank you very much for being with us. My hope is that people will read The Case for Impeachment, HarperCollins, and come up with some different ideas than what they might have already had. I think you've laid out some interesting constructs, and we should continue this dialogue.
Absolutely, Gary, and there's a lot more in the book. Take care.
All the best. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more. And tonight, we're going to continue for a full hour of an outstanding guest. We're going to have Tim Heaton back on to continue the conversation about the politicalization of Christianity among the Christian right and the GOP. Have a nice day, everyone.